This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, May 7th, 2013. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, the number of sexual assaults in the U.S. military is rising up to an estimated 70 per day as Congress considers bills to address the widespread problem. Big banks are violating the terms of the massive mortgage settlement. New York's Attorney General says he'll take action while activists demand an end to too big to jail. And as the number of Syrians driven from their homes by violence tops 4 million, many struggle with physical injuries and mental health issues. Those stories and more coming up.
I'm Nell Abram with FSRN Headlines. The Mississippi Supreme Court has granted an 11th-hour indefinite stay of execution for a man the state was set to kill at 6 p.m. local time this evening. The court said it needed more time to consider the claim that DNA evidence could clear Willie Jerome Manning, who was convicted in 1994 of killing two white university students. Manning is African American. As elections in Pakistan near, political violence continues. Two explosions today in northwest Pakistan killed at least 15 people. The first blast was at a rally for an Islamist party candidate. At least 10 people died and dozens of others were injured. The same party was targeted yesterday when 25 people were killed at a similar event. The Taliban claim responsibility for that attack. The group has also specifically threatened the Pakistan People's Party, who came under attack today when a candidate's car was bombed. He survived. His brother and at least three others did not. Much of the recent electoral violence has been aimed at the secular Awami National Party, who no longer schedule public rallies. Polls are set for Saturday, May 11th, and the military is poised to position more than 500,000 troops near polling stations. Two journalists were arrested in Zimbabwe today for allegedly publishing a story that was biased against the state. They were later freed, but still face charges. Gerikai Chaunza reports.
The editor of the Zimbabwe Independent, Dumisani Muleya, and the senior political correspondent, Owen Gagari, were charged with publishing falsehoods that were prejudicial to the state. The allegations stem from a recent report that Prime Minister Morgan Tsvangirai's party was in talks with the military and police chiefs to prevent a possible coup attempt should he beat incumbent President Robert Mugabe in upcoming elections. The Zimbabwe National Editors Forum says the arrests are politically motivated harassment of the media. Chairperson Brian Mangwende.
We are going to lobby the principals in the inclusive government. We are going to lobby parliament. We are going to lobby the police commissioner general so that this does not continue happening.
Last week, Reporters Without Borders issued a statement calling Zimbabwe's President Robert Mugabe an information predator. Zimbabwe Lawyers for Human Rights is representing the accused. Gerikai Chaunza, FSRN, Harare.
U.S. lawmakers reintroduced a bill today that seeks to curtail discrimination against prospective adoptive or foster parents. The Every Child Deserves a Family Act would block federal funding for agencies or groups that bar otherwise qualified adults from adopting or fostering based on their marital status, gender identity, or sexual orientation. Further, the bill would also block groups that refuse services to children based on their gender identity. Steve Majors with the Family Equality Council says that of the 400,000 children currently in the nation's foster system, one-fourth are adoptable.
What we know from surveys of LGBT parents is that many of them, as many as 2 million of them, would foster and adopt if barriers to them taking part in the adoption and foster care system didn't exist.
This is the third try for the bill that failed to gain traction in the two previous congressional sessions. Lawmakers in Wisconsin are set to vote on a bill that would further limit how those on food assistance can spend their food stamp dollars. The measure would control what food items could be bought with most of a monthly food stamp allotment. Ostensibly, to rein in junk food buys and mandate a healthier diet, the bill would allow recipients to buy eggs, but not organic or brown eggs, milk, but not organic milk, whole wheat bread, but not gluten-free, and juice boxes, but only if made by Juicy Juice. If the bill passes, the Wisconsin Department of Health Services would need a federal waiver from the U.S. Department of Agriculture to implement the changes. And a coalition of advocacy groups sued the FDA because it continues to allow arsenic to be added to animal feed for chickens, turkeys, and hogs. Minnesota News Connections' John Michelson has more.
The suit was filed on behalf of a handful of advocacy groups, including the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy. Senior advisor David Wallinga says it stems from a petition that was filed against the FDA 3 years ago.
Basically saying, this is arsenic. We don't need it to raise these animals for meat. And in fact, it's a public health hazard. So let's do something about it. And we think that FDA did not respond to the petition. So we're filing suit to force their hand and protect public health.
The arsenic that is used in animal feed is known as organic. It had been considered somewhat benign, but Wallinga says in reality, arsenic is arsenic.
Whether you're talking about a chicken that's eating this arsenic in their feed or whether it's a human being who's taking it in somehow in the meat that they eat, the body can convert that organic form of arsenic into the other forms that are actually closely tied with risk of cancer.
The lawsuit filed by the advocacy group seeks to yank FDA approval of the four different animal feed arsenic products that are currently on the market. John Michelson, Minnesota News Connection.
For FSRN from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. The number of sexual assaults reported in the U.S. military increased last year, as did the number of women who chose not to report the crimes. A Pentagon survey released today estimates 26,000 sexual assaults, or more than 70 each day, but only 3,400 cases were reported. The findings come as the chief of the Air Force's Office on Sexual Assault Prevention was arrested himself for sexual assault. Some Congress members introduced bills last week and today to address these problems and ensure justice for the military's survivors. On Capitol Hill, FSRN's Alice Olstein has more.
Arlington County Police arrested Lieutenant Jeffrey Krasinski in a parking lot in the D.C. suburb early Sunday morning and charged him with sexual battery. Before his arrest, Krasinski was the chief of the Air Force's Sexual Assault Prevention and Response Program, the office responsible for the military branch's training, education, victim advocacy, reporting, and accountability around sexual assault. At a Senate Armed Services Committee hearing Tuesday morning, New York Democrat Kirsten Gillibrand told Air Force leaders that Lieutenant Krasinski's behavior shows a department-wide culture problem.
If the man in charge for the Air Force in preventing sexual assault is being alleged to have committed a sexual assault this weekend, obviously, there's a failing in training and understanding of what sexual assault is and how corrosive and damaging it is to good order and discipline.
Air Force Chief of Staff Mark Welsh told the committee Lieutenant Krasinski was qualified for his position and had no history of assault on his record. But he said the Air Force was committed to fully investigating this and every other reported instance of sexual assault and preventing such crimes in the future.
We can lead the pack in this. We have the ability, we have the organizational structure, the leadership, the training, the education, and a disciplinary system and a judicial process that allows us to attack every aspect of this problem. We should be the best in the world at it.
But many lawmakers and sexual assault survivors say the military's structure, training, and judicial process are part of the problem. A new Pentagon report released Tuesday shows unreported sexual assaults increased by several thousand last year, while reports of assault only rose by a few hundred. Missouri Democrat Claire McCaskill said this data and stories she's heard from military sexual assault survivors show that many are afraid to come forward out of fear of retaliation or because they know they have a slim chance of winning a conviction against their attackers.
If a victim does not believe that the system is capable of believing her, there's no point in risking your entire career.
McCaskill cited as an example the case of Vandenberg Air Force Base Captain Matthew Herrera, who was charged with aggravated sexual assault and convicted and sentenced to jail time by a military jury. Air Force Lieutenant General Susan Helms overruled the jury's conviction without explanation last year, granting Herrera clemency for his crime. The president nominated General Helms in March to be vice commander of the Air Force's Space Command, but McCaskill says she can't allow Helms to be confirmed until she knows why she overruled the assault conviction. McCaskill also joined with colleagues in the House and Senate to introduce legislation to change the Uniform Code of Military Justice to strip commanders of the ability to overturn such convictions or reduce sentences, leaving the decision to an independent prosecutor and jury. Pentagon Chief Chuck Hagel recently voiced support for this change, but other military leaders, including Air Force Secretary Michael Donnelly, oppose it.
Commanders need to be part of the good order and discipline for their units. If they are cut out in some specific way, it's not good.
Donnelly went on to say that instances in which a commander overturns a conviction are very rare and thus aren't a contributor to the military's permissive culture around sexual assault. But many service member advocates, including Brian Pergia with the group Protect Our Defenders, say giving commanders authority over such cases discourages survivors from reporting.
Think about it. If you were assaulted by your boss, would you want to go ahead and report that assault to your boss or a superior who may be friends with them? It does not make any sense. The reporting, investigation, adjudication has to be taken out of the chain of command.
He agreed with Secretary Donnelly that it's rare for sexual assault convictions to be overturned by commanders, but said that's because it's rare for a sexual assault case to even go to trial and achieve a conviction in the first place. He said more accountability and harsher consequences would serve as a deterrent.
There needs to be rule of law. There needs to be punishment. People need to go to jail. People need to be fired for sexual assault. Currently, that does not happen. It's a very, very, very rare phenomenon.
Washington Democrat Patty Murray and New Hampshire Republican Kelly Ayotte also introduced the Combat Military Sexual Assault Act in the Senate Tuesday, which would assign a special victims counsel to assault survivors in the armed forces to help them navigate the military's legal process and bring attackers to justice. Alice Olstein, Free Speech Radio News, Washington.
When federal and state authorities got five of the country's largest mortgage companies to change their policies in a settlement last year, consumer advocates expressed hope that some of the practices that contributed to the housing crisis would be addressed, enabling thousands of homeowners to stay in their homes. Now, New York Attorney General Eric Schneiderman says some of the banks are flagrantly violating the terms of the national mortgage settlement, and his office plans to sue two of them, Wells Fargo and Bank of America. Schneiderman's announcement arrives as other banks face lawsuits for mortgage and foreclosure abuse, and as activists prepare for a week of action in Washington to demand relief for communities devastated by the foreclosure epidemic. FSRN contributor Anna Simonton reports.
The service standards mandated by the National Mortgage Settlement were intended to prevent banks from sending homeowners into foreclosure after losing the borrower's paperwork, failing to communicate in a timely manner, or issuing unwarranted fees, all practices that fueled the foreclosure crisis. New York Attorney General Eric Schneiderman says that over a year after the standards were enacted, homeowners in his state continue to suffer as a result of the bank's violations of the agreement.
If you are a homeowner facing foreclosure, time is your greatest enemy. Every day wasted, waiting for a bank to respond or for your chance to resubmit documents, is a day homeowners fall further behind, accumulate more fees and more interest. These delays often make the difference between a family staying in their home or being displaced.
According to nonprofit group Legal Services NYC, many homeowners seeking loan modifications in New York City spend 2 years in negotiations and go to court 6 to 8 times before reaching an agreement with their bank. Wells Fargo and Bank of America are not only neglecting servicing standards in New York. Kevin Wayland with the activist group Home Defenders League says that nationwide, homeowners have not been able to count on enforcement of the national mortgage settlement.
There's nothing that systematically has made homeowners whole the way banks were made whole and made, you know, wildly profitable again off of a bailout. So the response people get when doing individually trying to work out their situation still varies widely from cooperation to obstruction.
The Home Defenders League says Schneiderman's action is a good first step and emphasizes that more needs to be done on both the state and federal levels. Wayland points to California, where a homeowner's Bill of Rights went into effect at the beginning of the year. In February, the Los Angeles Times reported a 60% decrease in foreclosure starts compared with last December, attributing the drop in large part to the bill's provisions. At the federal level, the Home Defenders League advocates for the Obama administration to keep the promises made in the president's 2012 State of the Union address, when he committed to launching an investigation into holding big banks accountable for breaking the law. The president has not delivered on this promise, and in March, Attorney General Eric Holder told the Senate Judiciary Committee that the Department of Justice may not pursue filing charges against banks because of the catastrophic impact it could have on the economy. In response, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders introduced legislation that would require the Treasury to identify and break up banks that are considered too big to fail.
Anyone who reads the papers and week after week sees the kind of illegal activity being perpetrated by huge financial institutions is beginning to catch on that fraud is in fact the business model of Wall Street, that it's not the exception to the rule, it is the rule. And at the very least, what we have got to do is move aggressively to break up these huge financial institutions who have unbelievable economic power through their concentration of ownership and tremendous political power as well.
Next week, a coalition of groups organized by the Home Defenders League and Campaign for a Fair Settlement will converge in Washington for workshops, direct action training, and to deliver personal stories of families facing foreclosure to leaders on Capitol Hill. The groups say they will collectively demand help for families suffering from the foreclosure crisis and an end to the too-big-to-jail policy. Anna Simonton, Free Speech Radio News.
This is FSNN reporter MJ Del Valle in Tbilisi, Georgia. Free Speech Radio News has been an essential outlet for my stories from the Caucasus region, including in-depth looks at the recent Armenian presidential election, the creative ways protesters in Azerbaijan are using to fight for freedom of expression and labor struggles in the Republic of Georgia. But FSRN, along with the voices of people struggling for dignity, equality, and human rights, could be silenced. Find out how can you support independent grassroots journalists at fsrn.org.
As fighting continues in Syria, the violence is driving an increasing number of people from their homes. More than 4.25 million have been displaced within the country, according to the UN's Office of the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs. And that's in addition to the 1.4 million who have fled across borders to nearby Turkey, Jordan, Lebanon, and elsewhere. The highest concentration of refugees comes from Aleppo in the north of the country, where more than 1 million have fled their homes, often to unstable and dangerous circumstances. One of them is 18-year-old Salwe, a young woman who fled across the border to Turkey after being shot by a sniper.
I was living in the old city of Aleppo. I was making my way home on November 25th. A main street was closed, so I decided to take another route. When I was about to cross the square, a sniper shot at me from a high building, and I was injured.
Salwe underwent surgery at an Aleppo hospital where the bullets were removed from her body. She remained in critical care until, with the assistance from Doctors Without Borders, she was able to get across the border to Turkey. She said she is better, but still unable to walk. Doctors Without Borders continues to operate field hospitals within Syria, but the humanitarian group warns that supplies are inadequate to meet the growing needs of residents affected by the ongoing violence. For more, we're joined by Alexander Bookman. He's an emergency coordinator with Doctors Without Borders. Recently in Syria, he joins us from Washington, D.C. Welcome to FSRN.
Thank you very much.
Describe the hospital where you were working and the circumstances in that area.
Well, we're working out of so-called field hospitals, makeshift field hospitals, and we have set up our hospital and medical structure in an abandoned chicken farm, which is basically the easiest way to get a complete hospital into one structure. It's based in the northwest of Syria, and we are offering a comprehensive set of services, both both emergency related but also services related to the general lack of health care in Syria right now.
And typically, how many people do you service per day, or what's your population like there?
Well, we go from an estimated figure of roughly 100,000 people as our coverage population in that area. And we sometimes serve between 300 and 400 a day, of course, fluctuating with the warring activities in the region. But we have a lot of people coming to see us. And over the last months, we have done more than 400 deliveries, for instance. We've done 30,000 consultations in the emergency room and with our outreach mobile clinics, and we've done over 1,500 surgeries.
What are people most commonly asking for? What kind of services do they most commonly need?
Well, what you get is a system which previously was a very high-level system. So Syrians used to be able to get, for instance, free heart surgery in high technical hospitals. But now, if you're lucky, you can find a pharmacy with a little bit of paracetamol on the shelf. The situation is catastrophic in that sense. And the collapse of the health system that worked and covered the whole country before the war is basically non-existent. So we get everything from the common cough and influenza to people coming in with very, very serious injuries due to the warring activities. And we cover the whole spectrum of that.
The UN Humanitarian Office has upped the number of internally displaced to 4.25 million. What is the infrastructure like inside the country for this people? What are the needs?
Well, we see we can confirm the fact that there is an increase, and people are fleeing the central parts of the country towards the border areas, and there is a desperate need right now for help towards the internally displaced people as well. I mean, villages that used to have 50 families, they are now hosting up to 500 families. And with the dry summer season approaching, there will probably be really big problems in terms of water and sanitation. So we are already focusing on preventive measures to avoid having epidemics like diarrhea and measles outbreaks in order to, because when you get people stuck in an area which is not logistically and does have the infrastructure to cope with such amount of people, what you get is usually a health hazard. And this is what we're looking into right now.
In the U.S. and in other countries, there's a debate over what kind of involvement the world community should play in the Syrian conflict, over whether there should be possible military intervention. That debate will continue. But to focus on the humanitarian obligation, is the response from the world community adequate at this point to what you are seeing on the ground?
Well, first of all, as human beings, we do have a responsibility to respond to this catastrophic situation. Right now, much more aid is needed, and it must be deployed by whatever means are possible. Right now, the solution is not perfect, and it's Damascus who is basically holding the key to unlock the paralysis, and the government must publicly commit to allowing a free circulation of independent aid to wherever it is needed in Syria. But for now, the imperfect solution that we have must be massively scaled up, and cross-border aid in the north and in the south must be authorized by Damascus.
Alexander Bookman with Doctors Without Borders. Before I let you go, there is a UN commission that is investigating allegations of chemical weapons. That inquiry is still ongoing. In your time there in Syria, did you or your staff see any evidence of use of chemical weapons by any of the parties in the conflict?
We have, as Doctors Without Borders, not seen any clear evidence of the use of such agents. So for us, no matter who is supposed to have been using such, we haven't seen any evidence of it.
Alexander Bookman is an emergency coordinator with Doctors Without Borders. He was recently in Syria at a field hospital there. He joined us from Washington, D.C. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
In Bangladesh, the death toll from the garment factory building collapse has risen past 740 people as workers and family members of those killed in the April 24th disaster increase their demands for reform in the garment industry. Today, hundreds of survivors of the collapse blocked a main highway near Dhaka in a sit-down protest. According to Bangladesh's Daily Star, the workers are calling for payment from factory owners and for compensation for injuries. Many earned less than $40 per month at the factories, which supplied products to prominent Western brands. Meanwhile, many families are still awaiting word on their loved ones as efforts continue at the site. The International Federation of the Red Cross, or the IFRC, and the Bangladesh Red Crescent are part of those efforts. UN Radio's Beng Poblete Enriquez reports.
Jessica Salabank, spokesperson for the IFRC, says it's a terrible situation in Bangladesh during these past 2 weeks, where the exact number of people who died in the disaster is still unknown and where loved ones are still waiting and hoping.
They're still finding people in the rubble, so it's very hard to know exactly how many people have perished in that disaster. Many people still unaccounted for, many bodies still not identified, which is obviously creating a very distressing situation for people waiting for news of their loved ones.
The Bangladeshi Red Crescent, with its 110 trained volunteers, had been assisting in every way it could. Mr. Nurul Amin, the Assistant Director for Disaster Response Department in Bangladesh, says he and the volunteers are assisting in a number of ways.
I assist to the recovery of the body and packaging the body bag. And our 110 volunteers assist the government armed forces and given first aid and given medicament also. Healthcare support also and blood donation, collection the blood and given to those who are wounded. And family restoring also, those who are yet not find out the dead body, their family linkage.
But what caused the building to collapse? Mr. Amin explains.
Building is initially five-storied building, officially approved, but the building owner increased the three-storied without permission. This is one of the reasons, the collapse. Before day of the collapse, some engineer told the owners to stop the work in the building, but the building owners and the garments owners continue the garments activity.
In addition to response and rescue, the IFRC also has a program to look at laws, how they can impact and help facilitate better disaster response and also disaster preparedness. Elis Moschini is an attorney working for the IFRC Disaster Law Department, specializing in simplistic tones in the rules and regulations that surround disaster response and risk reduction.
Here we see a very unfortunate case example of the difference that good laws, strong laws, effective laws, and their enforcement can make in preventing disasters. So in this case, we see a building which was built with, we understand, quite shoddy materials. And then to top that off, to have a building code in country, which is actually quite new and quite reasonable, we understand. I mean, in terms of what's written in it, it should prevent this type of disaster. However, it's not necessarily enforced. And so in this case, it really brings it down to reality that if we don't pay attention to these issues, this is the scale of the disaster that can result.
Given the rising trends of urban development and mass movements of people towards urban areas, Elise says you can imagine this sort of issue happening more frequently. Unfortunately. Beng Poblete Enriquez, United Nations.
And that's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Kopp. Headlines editor was Nell Abram. Our Washington, D.C. editor, Alice Olstein. Our technical production team at KPFA Berkeley is Rose Katapchi and Janine Etter. Our theme music was composed and produced for FSRN by Alan Weatherhead. Thanks for listening. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina.